From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Another Titanic weekend at the box office for Avengers Endgame. In fact, it passed Titanic to become the second highest grossing movie of all time, just 11 days after opening. Avengers Endgame marks apparently, maybe not, the end of an 11-year, 22-film saga from Marvel Studios that changed how Hollywood approaches blockbuster movie making. Marvel has produced half of the 10 highest-grossing films of all time. And millions of fans are all in on the cinematic universe of Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, Doctor Strange, Black Panther, and more. But is that a good thing for movie-making? Or has Marvel become the Thanos of Tinseltown? Yes, friends, I just said that. This hour on Point, Avengers Endgame and how Marvel remade Hollywood. And you can join us. What did you think of the latest Avengers adventure? Is Marvel's box office dominance good for Hollywood, especially now that it's inside the world of Disney? Or is it crowding out other films and stifling creativity and originality? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And let's get some sound in here from the movie itself. Avengers Endgame, as you all probably know already, it picks up right where Infinity War left off after Thanos used the Infinity Stones to disintegrate half of all life in the universe. And in this scene from Endgame, Black Widow, played by Scarlett Johansson, and the Hulk, played by Mark Ruffalo, Captain Marvel, played by Brie Larson, and War Machine, played by Don Cheadle, they all plan on how to travel through time to fix the chaos that Thanos sowed.
Even if there's a small chance that we can undo this, I mean, we owe it to everyone who's not in this room to try.
If we do this, how do we know it's going to end any differently than it did before?
Because before you didn't have me.
Hey, new girl, everybody in this room is about that superhero life. And if you don't mind my asking, where the hell have you been all this time?
There are a lot of other planets in the universe. And unfortunately, they didn't have you guys.
A scene from Avengers Endgame. Joining us now from Chicago, Illinois, is Brandon Pope. He's a reporter and anchor at WCIU's television morning show, The Jam. He attended a 59-hour screening of all 22 Marvel Cinematic Universe films in a downtown Chicago theater, and he documented it all on Twitter using the hashtag #BePopesEndgame. Brandon, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Meghna, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So was it worth it, the 59-hour epic saga? Was it worth it?
I think it was. The movie was probably one of the most satisfying experiences I've ever had because I saw all those films. I went through all of that, but it checked off so many boxes in terms of nostalgia, in terms of reminiscing on what we've already been through with the Marvel Universe. It was just a great closing chapter. I've never been so satisfied by a film after watching Endgame than this one.
Well, that's great to hear because you were in the theater for 60 hours.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So tell us, I mean, I kind of want to know what the mechanics are of how you do that. How do you watch 22 films in a row?
Yeah, it's wild. So like the station I work for, the Jam, they issued this challenge for me to stay in the theater the entire time, couldn't leave. And so I had to try to figure out how do I sleep? what movies do I nap through? Do I nap through any movies? What do I eat? So I talked to the dietitian and we figured out, you know, the best eating strategy, snacks, light snacks, no big meals. I did not do any pop or soda. And then, I took quick naps during like Thor, The Dark World, the first Captain America. But it's kind of hard to nap in a theater, right?
Right.
You have these explosions and these loud noises and clapping, so you're going to wake up anyway. So I was definitely exhausted by the end of it. It wasn't a great strategy, but I think I survived as much as I could.
Well, you survived in good shape. You're here to tell the tale. Now, who else came? Because this is what I want to know, because there are so many fans of these Marvel movies. I mean, was it kind of a cross-section of folks who came for this 22-movie marathon?
You know, Meghna, that was one of the most amazing things I noticed about this. I know that I'm a fan. I know fans, but like people came to this location, this Chicago theater, from across the country. There are people from Dallas, Texas, Minnesota, Florida, California, like people like traveled with the intention of sitting in this theater and watching these films, which is something I couldn't fathom doing. And I guess there were only three theaters in the country with AMC that were doing this: Chicago, New York, and I think San Francisco. But to meet people who came from some of them drove, some of them flew, and they weren't planning on seeing The Bean. They weren't planning on seeing any of the tourist attractions. They were just there to sit in a theater for 3 days. That's dedication.
Wow. Now, Brandon, you, in writing about your movie, Marvel Movie Marathon, you wrote how, if I remember correctly, that when Iron Man first came out, way back when, you were in high school, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm trying to think. 2008, yeah. I was in high school.
Okay. So for a huge portion of your life, these films have defined what Hollywood movie making is for you. I'm just wondering what you think about that, that this one, you know, sort of huge universe of films, granted, is so central to how, you know, your relationship with the movies.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's changed the way that it's changed what people's view of superhero movies are. I mean, I remember Blade. I remember the first Spider-Man films and things like that. And just the MCU just changed the game, right? They took these obscure characters that nobody really cared about. You know, Iron Man was not a huge name before the movie came out at all, right? But they were able to find ways to create this magic and help you fall in love with these characters. And so now a talking raccoon and a talking tree, is a top-selling toy. You know, that's wild to me. And to see that shift and also see how other studios have tried to replicate the same model and not been as successful, it kind of shows the power that Marvel has and what they've done here with the power of Disney, too, to create these interconnected stories, bring all these famous actors together who are enjoying the experience and wanting to come back. Like, everybody wants to be a part of a Marvel film.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really amazing thing to have that be a part of my experience growing up. And then the idea of it possibly, you know, having a conclusion, it's still something I'm not really sure how to wrestle with yet. But it's been an amazing ride for sure, right?
Okay, one more question for you, Brandon. If Marvel, yeah, not if, it does carry so much weight in Hollywood right now, let's talk for a second about its broader influence then. And I'm thinking specifically that, you know, it took a while for it to embrace, you know, diversity even amongst its characters. Like, Black Panther is a standout film, but it came much later in the Marvel universe as we know it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, you know, movies like that had great impact. And I think it'd be fair to say Marvel and Disney did not anticipate the reaction and the cultural impact it would have. I think that's a Hollywood problem in general, that they have a lot of no representation at the top from, you know, diverse voices, right? So they don't know what the conversations are like culturally in those other spaces. I knew from the get-go, once a Black Panther movie was announced, that this was going to be a big deal.
Yeah.
You could see from the Twitter conversation, there was already a hashtag, Black Panther So Lit. Like, there was lots of movement for a movie that had no development yet, just an announcement, right? Yeah. So when you have films like that, and then Captain Marvel now, the representation of that, and then now we're seeing Marvel embracing the diversity, they're seeing that, embracing diverse voices sells. You know, there's other people out there that want to see themselves reflected in these films. And I think it's better for everybody in the long run as well.
Yeah. Well, Brandon Pope with us from Chicago, Illinois, reporter and anchor at WCIU Television's morning show, The Jam, who heroically attended a 59-hour Marvel movie marathon. Brandon, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. Have a great day.
All right, let's turn now to Abraham Reisman. He joins us from New York. He's a writer at New York Magazine and at Vulture, and he's working on a biography of Marvel Comics legend Stan Lee, slated to come out in 2020. Abraham Reisman, it's great to have you back on Point.
Oh, great. It's great to be here. I'm a big fan.
All right. So you heard Brandon there talking about how he really enjoyed Endgame. Did you feel the same way? Is it a fitting maybe ending to this 22 movie series?
Well, if you're asking about my feelings, it was a bit hot and cold. I saw it for the first time at a media screening. So it was mostly journalists, writers, that sort of person. And that kind of crowd tends to be pretty jaded and cynical,
right.
Because all of us journalists are dead inside. So the responses were like positive, but I, too, was kind of removed to a certain extent emotionally. I was thinking, you know, it's kind of frustrating, the cultural hegemony that these movies have and, like, they're, you know, products that produce content more than, you know, pure art and, you know, all the usual complaints. And I still sort of marveled at its technical ambition and the way it stuck the landing in terms of tying up threads. But it was more of an abstract appreciation. Then I saw the response from fans and critics, and I thought, maybe there's something I'm missing here. Like, maybe I overlooked something. So I went again on opening day with a packed house in Brooklyn, and I decided I'm going to tap into the emotions that other people are having. I'm going to pay really close attention to how the crowd is reacting because I know what's going to happen on screen. It's okay. And once I was really clued into those emotions, I was deeply moved.
Yeah.
Like once I sort of removed my diamond heart exterior, I found myself very vulnerable in this movie. And I was a weeping, blubbering mess at the end.
You cried?
No spoilers, but I cried very hard. Well, I'm a big enough man to admit on national public radio that I cried. Yes.
We're a bunch of criers here. Don't worry. I love that it reached you that way because you were watching it with fans. So we're going to talk more about that when we come back. We are talking about Avengers Endgame and how Marvel has changed movie making as we know it. Have you seen the film? Are you a huge Marvel fan? Or do you lament the way superhero films seem to suck up all the money when it comes to Hollywood? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about Avengers Endgame. It is maybe the end, probably not when it comes to Marvel movies, but it is the 22nd film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And we're talking about why fans love these movies so much and how it's really changed Hollywood. Let's hear a little bit more from Endgame itself. Now, recall, at the end of Avengers Infinity War, the villain Thanos snaps his fingers, disintegrates half of all life across the universe, including many of the Marvel superheroes. So in Endgame, the rest of the team has to come to terms with that new reality and what to do about it. So the first voice you're going to hear in this clip is Captain America, Steve Rogers, who's played by Chris Evans, and then Black Widow, played by Scarlett Johansson.
We lost, all of us. We lost friends. We lost family. We lost a part of ourselves. This is the fight of our lives.
This is gonna work, Steve.
I know it is. Because I don't know what I'm gonna do if it doesn't.
A scene from Avengers Endgame. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're joined today by Abraham Reisman. He's a writer at New York Magazine and Vulture. And Abe, before I go back to you, we've got some callers who want to get their say in here about Endgame. So let me just go straight to them quickly. Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Limerick, Maine. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, how we doing?
I'm doing great. So you saw the movie, right? What'd you think of it?
Oh, I thought the movie was great and everything. I guess my big comment is on whether or not cinema is being crowded out by the Marvel Universe and stuff. I really don't think the people in cinema have much to complain about because the traditional, you know, Oscar-type movies have dominated the cinema for decades. And now Marvel has shown up, and all they're asking for is some of their own space to tell their stories. Now, whether or not they're going to dominate forever, I doubt it. But there'll be another genre, just like all the other genre movies that are out there.
Right. Well, Ray, thank you so much for your call. So Abraham Reisman, respond to that. Ray's saying, let him do it. It's great. It's also giving millions of people a lot of, cinematic pleasure.
Sure, but the counter argument to that is we're increasingly reaching this place where cinematic releases are just supposed to be gigantic blockbusters. And a lot of that is a consequence of the transition to streaming, where people watch things that are not blockbustery, generally just at home on their couches, scrolling through a streaming service. So in order to get people to come out to the multiplex, studios tend to focus on these gigantic communal experiences, which really are wonderful communal experiences if that's the sort of thing you're into. But there is a limited pool of money out there, and it just is the case that mid-budget films are really being crowded out by stuff like the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
But let me just push back on that for a second here, because if I remember correctly, I'm going to fact check myself here in a second, but
yeah,
it was either last year or the year before, Netflix itself was going to invest some $8 billion in original content. So for all those dramatic high art films that maybe don't have a Sony or a Disney behind them anymore, so what? They have a place to go.
Yeah, but honestly, I mean, I don't want to get too critical, but a lot of streaming services, we pay attention to the small number of really good original pieces of content that they have, but they kind of have this throw it all against the wall and see what sticks strategy, and there's not as much curating, and we're getting kind of granular here, and I'm probably just being a snob, but I do see the complaints. I'm not as much of a Chicken Little about the fact that stuff like the Marvel Cinematic Universe is so big, but I get where people are coming from.
All right, we're going to dig into that a lot more here, but there's something that I wanted to come back to you with, or something that you said earlier that I wanted to dig into a little bit more, that you said when you saw Endgame with fans, it was a completely different experience for you. It was more emotional. You cried. You were connected to the film in a way that you weren't when you watched it in a screener as a journalist. So what is it that these movies are providing to fans that elicits that response?
I mean, at the risk of sounding cliche, I mean, these are primordial archetypes that you're dealing with. I mean, you can overstate something like that, but these movies operate kind of on the level of myth. These are characters that, somebody like Captain America is so archetypally good that he's in no way realistic, but that's not the point. The idea is he's supposed to, represent an ideal, blah, blah, blah. And I'm obviously sort of jaded about that because, again, I'm a big old snob and elitist, but I completely get why and appreciate why people really respond to that, because it gets at your lizard brain. It gets at something that is deeper than, your educated frontal cortex. And that's a beautiful thing. I don't want to get in the way of people enjoying that. That's something that really helps people find joy in their lives. And it was great to see that on opening day.
All right. Well, let's go back in time. Or maybe I was just going to say that joy also allows fans to overlook some thin moments in the plot of it.
Yeah, there's some plot holes there
mentioning
that
going
you
back
have to do a big
time.
Old leap over. Yeah. Yeah, the time travel stuff was – I actually interviewed the directors, the Russo brothers, and asked them about time travel. And I said, how did this one plot point – how is it even possible given the rules of the time travel you had? And God bless him, Anthony Russo just said, time travel is always going to sort of fall apart because it's not real. Like, it's never going to totally make sense in a fictional work because it's not possible, which is a bit of a cop-out. But I was like, all right, fair enough. Okay.
Doesn't seem to have bothered the millions of people who've seen this movie. But I do want to do the radio version of time travel and go back to listening to 2008's Iron Man, because one of the things that the Marvel Cinematic Universe does so well and that really sort of draws people in for the next film is that they have post-credits scenes, okay? So here's the scene from the end of the first Marvel Cinematic Universe film, Iron Man, again from 2008, where Tony Stark, played by Robert Downey Jr., comes home and encounters Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson.
You think you're the only superhero in the world? Mr. Stark, you've become part of a bigger universe. You just don't know it yet.
Who the hell are you?
Nick Fury, director of S.H.I.E.L.D. I'm here to talk to you about the Avenger Initiative.
That is the scene from after the credits from Iron Man in 2008. Well, joining us now is Ben Fritz. He's with us from NPR West in Culver City, California. He's the West Coast Bureau Chief and Editor for The Wall Street Journal, where he covers the film business. He's also author of The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. Ben Fritz, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to play that post-credit scene from Iron Man because you use it as a springboard to ask you, how did Marvel do this? How did it take a bunch of its B and even C-list superheroes and create a juggernaut that's completely changed Hollywood?
Well, you know, there's two great questions there in the history is how did they do it as a business and how did they do it creatively? That clip points to how they did it creatively, which is that they created this interwoven cinematic universe where all the stories connect to each other. And it's an idea that's been around for decades in comic books, but nobody did it in movies before. So instead of just being, well, the sequel to Iron Man is Iron Man 2, the sequel to Iron Man, as evidence there, is sort of the Hulk and it's sort of Thor because these characters all live in the same universe. All the movies are building toward the Avengers, the first few movies. And so if you saw one, you'd want to see the next one. And so it felt like every movie was a sequel. And if you enjoyed one, you had to see them all. And these post-credit scenes always kind of, instead of the film ending in a conclusion, it ended on a teaser for the next one. So they managed to make it so that every single one of these films felt like they were must-see for the fans. And so instead of waiting 2 or 3 years for a sequel, you just had to wait 6 or 8 months. And nobody had ever done that before. It's very risky, right? Because if one of the films is bad, then the whole cinematic universe would fall apart. But the fans engaged. Most of the movies were good. The fans turned out to be pretty forgiving of the ones that were not good. And it brought a level of consistent success that nobody has ever seen in Hollywood, nobody thought was possible in Hollywood before Marvel.
And when Marvel decided to embark on this endeavor, though, they were in maybe not the strongest financial position. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, the way to understand how this all started, you have to go back to the late 90s when Marvel was coming out of one of the most protracted corporate bankruptcies in American history. And they had absolutely no money. And one of the ways they raised money was to sell the film rights to Hollywood studios. And they sold the rights to Spider-Man to Sony Pictures for $10 million per film. Cut to a few years later, Spider-Man comes out, the first ones with Tobey Maguire. They're massively successful. And the executives at Marvel were sitting there being like, wait a minute, Sony's making more money off our characters than we are. And everybody in the world thinks it's Sony Spider-Man. They don't think of it as Marvel Spider-Man. So they started saying, maybe we should make our own movies. Maybe we should control our own destiny. And they raised money on Wall Street back when there was a lot of cash flowing around before the financial crash. And they raised about $500 million to make their own films. But they only had sort of the B-list characters because they had licensed out Spider-Man to Sony and the X-Men to Fox. So when they were like, we're going to create our own movies, where we've never made movies before, we're a comic book company, and we're going to make them based on Iron Man and Thor and Captain America, which were they were basically the leftover characters nobody else in Hollywood wanted. There were a lot of skeptics, a lot of skeptics.
Well, and Abe Reisman, the other thing that Marvel did is maybe they made massive amounts of super profitable lemonade out of the lemons they had at the time because they weren't, you know, in the first Iron Man film, it's Robert Downey Jr. who's at the center of the movie, who at that point in time wasn't necessarily, you know, one of your super A-list Hollywood stars.
Correct. There's been this kind of Moneyball strategy throughout the Marvel Cinematic Universe where you buy low and sell high. You find talent that's undervalued and you hire it at a price that's a little more reasonable than if you're trying to hire somebody who's, you know, one of the biggest stars in the world. And you say, okay, this person's talented and we have a brand that people are interested in and we have characters that have been lasting and durable even if they aren't world famous yet. And then you basically turn people into stars. I mean, think about the lists of – it's funny. Somebody was passing around or a bunch of people were passing around this screenshot of an article that was written on Vulture or a news item back when Thor was cast. And it's like unknowns cast for Thor movie. And it's like Tom Hiddleston and Chris Hemsworth. Who are these people? And now you look at it and these with especially Chris Hemsworth, they're huge brand names. And so Robert Downey Jr. is a great example of that. He was at a low point in his career and had been at some low points in his life. And he was hired on to do this movie about this B, C list character. And a big portion of why people love the Marvel Cinematic Universe is they love watching Robert Downey Jr.'s journey, like metatextually. And it's been really fascinating to watch.
Well, in fact, during a half-hour oral history of the Marvel Cinematic Universe done for Rotten Tomatoes, the film website, Marvel Studio President Kevin Feige described the company's unorthodox approach to casting the first film back in the mid-2000s.
Iron Man, that's would be the marquee name, allowed us to say, let's just cast the best actor we can find. And it's funny to remember now, Robert Downey Jr. is the biggest star on the planet. What he was then was one of the best actors on the planet, not necessarily one of the biggest marquee stars on the planet. And it was liberating to make decisions like that that I don't know would have been made at other studios at the time.
That's Marvel President Kevin Feige. Ben Fritz, you've called him the most powerful person in Hollywood today.
He absolutely is. I mean, he controls a movie studio that generates more profits than anybody else. And it's consistently, right? They've essentially had only one sort of flop, which was The Incredible Hulk, the one with Ed Norton way back in 2008. That was it. Otherwise, they've all been successful and in most cases, massively successful. And Feige's been the only consistent person. They've gone through many different directors, actors, writers, right? The one person who's been involved in every film is Kevin Feige. And Marvel's philosophy very much is the filmmakers are not in control. It's not like the Dark Knight trilogy that's very much Christopher Nolan authored. This is authored by the company, and that was Marvel's purposeful strategy. They thought they knew the most about these characters. They knew more than anybody else did. And, you know, in a sense, it seems artist unfriendly, but there's no denying it's worked. And Kevin Feige has been the main executive behind it.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more of what Feige himself has to say about the kinds of Marvel characters they've put on the screen over the years. Again, for Rotten Tomatoes, this oral history of the cinematic universe they did, Feige said that since the beginning of his career regarding female Marvel characters, he felt that the notion of a, quote, damsel in distress was outdated, and he wanted to work hard to avoid that trope.
We really wanted to create these female characters that were as strong and as capable as the heroes. Now, as we've continued to grow, that's gotten even more apparent to the point where they are the heroes. And people already ask, when are they getting their movie? And the answer is, nobody wants to see that more than me. And that's a testament to that film and to those actresses and to the world being ready and being overdue to see these type of characters on the screen.
Well, let's go to Antoinette, who's calling from New Orleans. Antoinette, you're on the air. What do you think about the women in Endgame?
Hi. I found it interesting that it was the women that kind of rallied in the end. You had, Captain America, who is all of America but self-righteous at the same time. And then he was standing alone and everybody popped up. But it was the women at the end who was really, you know, they were like, hey, she's not alone. And then all these women rallied around Captain Marvel to you know, save the day, so to speak. I found that, is that what are we teaching girls today, that you really run the world, you have the power, you are going to be the ones that will lead them on. But I did find it interesting that in all of the death that was experienced, it was a fake man and a real woman that died. That did not come back. Mm-hmm. And so what is that saying at the same time? You know, women are right. Still, we are still gone, huh. In a sense. We're still expendable. We're there to push you through, and maybe that's one aspect of it. But then at the other time, we are expendable. You can go away. Yeah. You are willing to sacrifice yourself for all of man. At the same time, and so I, as a girl, as a woman, I saw it with my daughter, and she's the one who pointed it out to me. She says, "Mommy, look at all of the girls rallying around her."
Yeah, Antoinette, we just have a minute before we have to take a break. So I want to take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. I also probably should remind people that maybe no spoilers, guys, if for folks who haven't seen the movie yet. But Antoinette, thank you so much.
The day gets saved. That's crazy.
But Avery Reisman responded to what she was saying. We just got 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break about the women in the movie.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting female characters that get fleshed out in interesting ways. But, you know, to push back against Feige, if he really cared that much about having female leads, he would have done it sooner. So, you know, no offense, but...
There's
that
journalistic, cynical dive
sorry,
in the heart
I gotta,
of yours.
What they pay me the medium-sized bucks for. Yeah.
That's why we're glad to have you. So, Abraham Reisman and Ben Fritz, stand by here for a second. We are Yes, we are talking about Avengers Endgame and the 22 film universe from Marvel and how it's changed Hollywood and movie making. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Avengers Endgame and the 22-film Marvel Cinematic Universe and how it has changed Hollywood filmmaking. I'm joined today by Abraham Reisman. He is a writer at New York Magazine and Vulture. He's at work on a biography of Marvel Comics legend Stan Lee. Ben Fritz also joins us. He's West Coast bureau chief and editor for The Wall Street Journal, author of The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. Let's listen to a scene from the 2014 Marvel film Guardians of the Galaxy, where the Collector, played by Benicio del Toro, explains the Infinity Stones, a major plot point in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Then the universe exploded into existence, and the remnants of these systems were forged into concentrated ingots. Infinity Stones. These stones, it seems, can only be brandished by beings of extraordinary strength. Observe. These carriers can use this stone to mow down entire civilizations like wheat in a field.
Benicio del Toro in Guardians of the Galaxy. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Lincoln, Nebraska. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Yes, I have been listening to the program, excellent program. One of the concerns that I have, though, the amount of, I mean, it's almost like a monopoly that Disney is holding right now,
right,
between Star Wars and Marvel, and that we're being fed. Now, we can say no to the, to the theater. Boy, the temptation is really tough, though. But to go and to just, I'm envisioning a day when they do a remake of Gone with the Wind and everyone is wearing capes.
That's good.
Michael, thank you for your call, because you bring up actually an extraordinarily important point. And Ben Fritz, let me turn to you here, because we are sort of grappling with how Marvel has really changed movie making, but now we have to talk about it within the umbrella of Disney. I read somewhere that Disney, I think it was last year, secured what, a quarter of all box office receipts? Just one company?
Oh, yeah. I think it may have even been higher than that. Marvel, we're living in the franchise age of filmmaking is what I call in my book, which is basically, the cinema is dominated by these big brand names. And Disney has a lot of the best ones. Disney has Marvel. They have Pixar. They have Star Wars. They have these old Disney animated films they're remaking, like The Lion King that's coming up. These are brands that people love, especially internationally. People and audiences in China, which is the second biggest box office market in the world, they love brands. And people go to movies now. You know, it's expensive. You want to go see something where you kind of know what you're going to get. When you want to take a risk, you stay home and try that new thing on Netflix or HBO or FX. And, if you don't like it, all you've lost is time, right? The marginal cost is nothing. But if you're going to go out and spend money on popcorn and babysitters and movie tickets, it's kind of good to know what you're going to get. It turns out that's what people prefer. And that leans towards brands, and Disney has done an excellent job of collecting a lot of the best brands in Hollywood.
Well, we've got this comment that's come in from Ben Grimm, who says that now that Stan Lee is gone...
Okay, yeah.
Okay, you guys are far more in the know than I am. Was that funny?
Yeah, sorry.
His name is a joke?
It's a character.
Abe,
it's
you
want to
take this one?
Name.
Yeah, it's a character name, the Thing from the Fantastic Four, which, thanks to the sale of 21st Century Fox, now Disney owns.
As well.
That character is named Ben Grimm, yeah.
Okay, yep. So this Ben Grimm really has a gripe with Disney because Ben says, now that Stan Lee is gone, I don't want to see the soul of Marvel be taken away as was done to Lucasfilm. I mean, where's that story even going? Seriously, I haven't seen any Star Wars since J.J. Abrams first ruined it. Ben really not really pulling any punches here. No, what? Don't tell me. I'd rather see something from George Lucas than his former stolen studio. Is that a concern, Abramsman?
Well, first off, Stan Lee never had any involvement in any of the movies. He was out of the, you know, mainstream creative picture when it came to Marvel by the time all that stuff started to happen. But yeah, I don't know. If this person is upset about, you know, the original vision getting taken away from Marvel, then, I mean, that happened. That ship has sailed. There's not much to do about that. You know, this is the reality, is everything has become Disney-fied to a certain extent. And you just sort of have to make your peace with that, for better or worse.
But Ben Fritz, Bob Iger has said specifically, though, that he wants to narrow the focus of Disney's enormous capacity to these types of films. I mean, it is a cold-blooded business calculation here. So what cost? Yeah. What's the bigger cost to that for filmmaking in America?
Right. I had for my book, I had a pretty extraordinary interview with Iger, and he talked about how when he took over Disney as CEO, he looked at their movie business and he looked at the returns, the pure financials, and said, "Why are we making these non-franchise films? They don't make as much money." You know, he was like, he brought the example of Spotlight, which is a movie. He was like, "I love that, but it's just not a very good business." He said they're terrible businesses, and he wants to be in the best business. So that's why he's focused on franchise. Turns out a lot of audiences love that. They make the biggest profits. Disney makes more profits at movies than anybody else, any other studio, by a long shot. But yeah, the cost is a lot of these other types of films, these original films, don't get made because there's not room at the box office, because people go spend their limited amount of time and box office dollars on seeing The Avengers and Jurassic World and Fast and Furious. And, you know, it's 25 years ago, think about it, you know, Forrest Gump, Rain Man, these were like the number one movies in America. Literally. Yeah. And now it's unthinkable that they would be in the top 10. It's unlikely they would even get made.
Abe, I hear you lamenting there.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You know, you have this environment where, yes, there's still original content that wins Oscars. But for the most part, those kinds of movies, these mid-budget original screenplays, they go nowhere. They get completely crowded out. That's the kind of stuff that ends up on streaming or adapted into like an HBO series. And, you know, you can just say that's the way life works and tastes change and the economy changes. But it's hard not to feel like something was lost when that happened.
Right. Ben, you just to put a fine point on it, Iger sold Miramax, right? Shut down Touchstone. So these were, you know, so the indie branches of Disney, so no more indie movies. And you also write that he stopped making R-rated movies, stopped making romantic comedies, stopped all those original dramas for adults. So a really big change here, but it has worked to Disney's favor. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you, though, is, we're long past the time where we're talking about films made for American audiences, right? And these Marvel movies work great globally. The storylines, because they appear in alternate universe, there aren't cultural issues per se. Like, it just works for global audiences as well.
Yeah, right. They work all around the world, and that's super important. The movie business is not at all an American business anymore. And so you need films that, A, can be understandable in China, in Russia, in Brazil, and the U.S., and B, have great spectacle. People who are going to movies for the first time, these emerging middle classes around the world, they want to see something that they can never, ever see on TV or their phones, something that blows them away. And of course, that leans toward these $200, $300 million big budget effect spectacle films. And Marvel is perfect at these. You don't need to understand anything except Marvel itself to get the movie. And they're made on a budget with such amazing visual effects that it's still not something you could possibly get at home on a TV budget.
Well, let us go back to the many callers and fans who've been patiently waiting. Let's go to Christopher, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I had a question. We've talked a lot about how these movies are part of the classical pantheon that's kind of returning, but in that, I wanted to ask about storytelling. I think that the movies have not only changed the movie production studios and how studios are looking to make more money, but also just on our expectations on how to tell stories and what we need as a social group kind of in the world, more than visual effects, I think what we needed is to see our heroes fail and to know, you know, the first movie of this little pairing, everyone fails. You know, Thanos wins. And to know that the heroes themselves and that we, as we associate with these archetypes, can also return from failure, return from trauma, I think that's something that people feel all over the world. So I guess in the eyes of this new age of storytelling, what do you guys think is next?
But Christopher, before I'm going to let Abe and Ben answer that question for you, but isn't the hero falling and then rising the fundamental part of the hero's tale anyway for many thousands of years, and we're just sort of seeing it in a new form with these movies?
I think so, but I think that they hit on something earlier when they were talking about archetypes. I think we haven't seen this. I mean, you mentioned Forrest Gump. There was a moment in that movie where Forrest kind of fails, or you could say that he fails and then rises again, and we associate ourselves with that story. But I think that, again, more than the visual effect scale, I think seeing that kind of rise and fall and seeing that kind of emotion, that's why we cry at Endgame.
Yeah.
It's because we feel that so starkly. We feel that so deeply. We know what it's like to have failure in our own lives. We know what it's like to make choices to give up on our family in for other people.
Well, it's a great point, Christopher. Abe Reisman, what do you think?
Yeah, sure. These are universal emotions, and there's something to be said for figuring out how to manipulate the lowest common denominator. And I don't mean that derogatorily. I don't mean that derogatorily. I mean literally finding, you know, like in mathematics, finding the thing that all of the numbers can, I'm forgetting whether it's multiplied or divided by. I was terrible at math in school. But, you know, finding something that is so digestible for people who have nothing in common is, again, on just a pure technical and storytelling level, really an accomplishment. That's not something that's easy to pull off. You know, exciting at a universal level, that's not an easy status to get a movie to.
Yeah. All right, couple more calls. Let's go to Bobby, who's calling from Buford, Georgia. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hi, I am a lifelong comic fan, and I just feel I love the movies, and it's just been, after being a fan for so long, and having to defend the comics medium to pretty much all of the general public that it's been dismissed by, just to see so many people embrace these characters and these stories has been extremely validating. And I feel that it's really opened the doors for more comic stories to be taken seriously. And we might see those, you know, even if it's just brought in a movie form, at least it's exposing people to what comics really has to offer.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for your call. I want to go now to Mike, who's calling from Rochester, Michigan. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much for having me. I wanted to comment, push back a little bit to the commentator, the self-proclaimed elitist.
That's
the idea that, but you know, it's no surprise to me that these movies are exceptional and have wide base popularity because they precisely for the fact of what the commentator made a comment about using a lizard brain. These stories are as old as time. The first written story, the Epic of Gilgamesh, to the sagas and tropes of Beowulf, even you know, parallel into, you know, the gospels of the Christian faith about Jesus Christ. And all these storylines, all these archetypes are common throughout our communal cultural history of the last 10,000 years of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this is just our time and our cultural's evolution of that, in that we are telling these stories and these wrestling with these moral questions and dilemmas in a visual format.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's been a great experience for me. I'm 40 years old. I grew up playing the Iron Man video game and collecting X-Men trading cards back in my younger days.
Well, Mike, thank you for your call. I'm going to take it back from you because we just have 2 minutes left to go here. But Abe Reisman, I'm going to let you respond to Mike. But does his comment explain, I think in one of your articles you wrote that you were traveling somewhere and you saw an Avengers fan wearing a T-shirt, right, that said, just another Avengers fan who loves Jesus Christ.
I didn't write that, but I talked about it. Yeah, there was a T-shirt that somebody had at this event I went to that said, just another Marvel fan, or maybe it was Avengers fan, I can't remember, who loves Jesus Christ. And I thought this was so fascinating that you have you know, these cultural divides that get bridged by this brand. And the caller was completely right. I mean, these are archetypes that date back as far as Gilgamesh, and that's something to be admired and respected. But I guess I just sort of get frustrated with the fact that they tend to sort of crowd out your attention and, you know, keep you from also taking in things that have a different approach to storytelling and characterization.
Well, Ben Fritz, we've got a minute and a half left here to go, and let's underscore that this is obviously not the last Marvel film to come out, no matter what they're calling it. It's too is too golden for them to put it on the shelf. But what about other studios? Because Marvel has its own intellectual property to build from. I mean, if we're looking at a future of more studios trying to build these cinematic universes, do they have the same source material to draw from?
Some other studios do. There's definitely we're entering an age of big winners and big losers, where if you have a big franchise and you execute well, you can succeed. And if you don't, you're in a really bad position. You know, this past weekend, we just saw another movie that got good reviews, like The Long Shot with Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron, that bombed. And it's very hard for even good films that go up against these superhero movies to find any space. So, yes, if you look at Warner Brothers, they own the DC Comics characters like Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. They, if they execute well, should be able to play at this level. Universal has Fast and Furious and Jurassic World. Those are major franchises. But there's only room for a handful of these cinematic universes to succeed. People can't see all of them. And if you don't have one of those handfuls, you're in a tough spot, which is why you're seeing a lot of consolidation in Hollywood, and we're going to see fewer studios and fewer films in the future.
Yeah, well, they're doing something right, because we didn't get a single caller calling in lamenting the death of high art cinema.
That's right.
So Ben Fritz, West Coast Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal and author of The Big Picture. Ben, thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure, Meghna.
And Abraham Riesman, writer at New York Magazine and Vulture, working on a biography of Stan Lee. Abe, it was great to have you back on the show. Thanks so very much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.